Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. On November 23, 2012, a 45-year-old white gun collector and software engineer named Michael Dunn in Jacksonville, Florida, fired at least 8 shots into a car full of teenagers after admonishing them about the volume of their music. The shots hit and killed one of the 4 boys in the car, 17-year-old Jordan Davis, an African-American boy. Dunn reportedly said, "I hate that thug music," and quote unquote, when he drove up alongside the car that Davis and his friends sat in. He justified his actions, saying that he felt threatened when one of the car's occupants brandished a shotgun, but police found no weapons in Davis's car or in the surrounding area. The case shared many similarities with the shooting of Trayvon Martin. Eventually, Dunn was convicted last October of first-degree murder and is now serving a life sentence. Capturing the story of what happened is my guest, filmmaker Mark Silver. His documentary is called 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. The film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year and won the U.S. Documentary Special Jury Award for Social Impact. Mark Silver is best known for his 2014 documentary, Who is Dayani Kristal? And he now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. And I should mention the film has been bought by HBO, where it will be showing later in the year, but it's also opening up in theaters. Before we get to that, why first was this story so important for you to tell? This particular story that comes at a time of heightened interest in issues of racial justice, perhaps this new wave begun with the Trayvon Martin killing, although this story didn't get as much attention as Trayvon Martin's story.
Yeah, we first met Jordan's family a couple of weeks before the George Zimmerman verdict. And at the beginning, we were very interested in forensically looking at what happened during this 3.5 minutes where the two cars were next to each other. And at that point, we were looking at racial profiling, access to guns, and then laws that give people the confidence to actually use those guns. And then as the film evolved and we were editing the film, then Ferguson happened and all these other cases exploded. And at that point, we realized what happened in that 3.5 minutes was not just about the 3.5 minutes of Jordan Davis, the last 3.5 minutes of Jordan Davis's life, but were metaphorically important because they were also the 1.5 seconds that it took to kill Tamir Rice, or the 4 hours that Michael Brown lay on the floor in Ferguson. And that's when we realized the DNA of what happened to Jordan Davis in terms of why would a white man fear four black men was prevalent throughout all these other cases.
So you see these stories of what happened to Trayvon, what happened to Jordan, as part of the same framework of police killings, even though in this case it wasn't a policeman or even really someone associated with police who was the shooter. I mean, in George Zimmerman's case, he often identified with the police. He was a neighborhood watchman. But Michael Dunn, the shooter of Jordan Davis, why do you put this in the same framework?
Well, yeah, you're right. Michael Dunn was a citizen in these other cases. It was mainly police, but and of course I understand if people want to have the political will to disassociate all of these situations, but the thing that's the same in all of them, or the question that we think is a valid question to be asking about all of these cases, is why those white men felt fear.
Now, of course, also the police who are involved or have been involved in shootings aren't all white, but some say it's a sort of culture of white supremacy. And is that something that you also sort of are looking into?
Yeah, I mean, white supremacy didn't come up in our film overtly, but I think it's more about why is it that people... Maybe we flip it around and ask, what does blackness mean? In terms of the way that black men are perceived, and where does that construction of fear related to black men come from?
Of course, in my watching of your documentary, what really jumped out at me was the two parents who you focus on at length, Lucia McBath, the mother of Jordan Davis, and Ron Davis, the father. Lucia in particular, is a remarkable woman. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, actually, her father was involved in the civil rights movement back in the day and actually worked with Martin Luther King, I think. But what's extraordinary, I think, about the parents is that, firstly, they were divorced when Jordan was about 3 years old. So through the murder of Jordan, they've had to, you know, come back together and, if you like, continue to parent their son, even though he's not
looking
with them
justice,
anymore.
Yeah.
Absolutely, looking for justice. And unlike many other cases, you know, they were very fortunate that they did find justice. And I think the other thing that's amazing is that, you know, they weren't politically active people before this happened. And because of what happened to Jordan, this thing inside them, you know, is now out there in the world, and they're fighting for not just justice for Jordan, but again, like understanding the connections between all these other cases. And there's a scene in the film where Trayvon's dad speaks to Jordan's dad, and as Ron puts it, welcomes him to a club that no parent wants to be in. And now Ron himself is going to these other families and in turn welcoming them into a club that, of course, no parent ever wants to be in.
Yeah, I spoke with Lucia McBath on our show Uprising in 2013. This was when the trial of Michael Dunn was still in progress. And I want to play an excerpt of this interview that I did with her, where I asked her about how she's coping. How has your family been faring through this entire process? I cannot even begin to imagine your grief.
It's very, very, of course, it's very difficult. I say all the time, you know, it doesn't get easier. It just becomes a little bit more bearable. Every time that we're able to talk about Jordan, every time we're able to share to others who he was as an individual and what he meant to us, it just makes it a little bit easier. The work that we're doing now, the advocacy, I've taken a position as national spokesperson for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, and that means the world to me to be able to know that I'm actively working towards, you know, changing the laws so that no other parent has to suffer this way. So there are things that his father and I are doing to you know, walk out a lot of the pain. But, of course, we have our good days and bad days.
Lucia McBath, the mother of Jordan Davis, speaking to me on Uprising in 2013. This was when the trial of Michael Dunn was still in progress and it wasn't known which way that trial would go. And, of course, if we look at other legal precedent, there wasn't much reason to be optimistic about a good outcome. But the story of her grief and Ron's grief, you have many moments in the film where you just capture them crying. It was difficult to watch. He was their only child, and you mentioned in the film it's brought up that she had trouble getting pregnant, and even footage of Jordan as a baby. And how important was it to paint this picture? We never, of course, ever really see Jordan as he was before he died, except for photographs. But then there's footage of him as a child.
Yeah, I mean, there are very few words to describe how it must feel as a parent, obviously, to bury your child. What I found extraordinary was this idea of irreversible loss. Like it was a very, very hard thing to capture something so profound. And I had, you know, so much respect for Jordan's parents for them to allow us to be so intimate with them and follow them through the horror of having to sit through this trial. So we were with them, you know, as they were getting ready in the morning to go to court. We spent all day with them in court, and then we would come home with them in the evening. And not only would they have to go through the day in court, but then in a very strange way, they would then have to watch the news, you know, that morning or that evening, and then see themselves suffering in court, you know, daily, day in and day out, watching themselves on the news. And, you know, I thought it was very important that we didn't, the film was not just about the trial, but it's really about the impact that this has on families. And, you know, I must say also that it wasn't just, you know, Jordan's family who were affected by this. This is a tragedy for both families involved. The shooter's family, Michael Dunn's family, have also been totally destroyed. And his fiance at the time is now no longer with him. He's obviously spending the rest of his life in prison. And I think it's very important to look at all of these cases. And, you know, there are lessons to be learned on both sides, right, about maybe taking a minute to really think about whether you need to use that weapon.
Yeah. So let's talk about that other person who makes quite an appearance in the film, and that's, of course, the shooter himself. And what was interesting about, and perhaps for you, quite fortunate as a filmmaker, that Michael Dunn sort of laid it all out there. There's a lot of available footage of him just kind of baring his soul and allowing us a peek into what he might have been feeling about himself. I think the most bizarre moment of the film, he compared himself to a rape victim who is blamed for being raped. He was so confident that he would be exonerated.
Yeah, there's I mean, often in the screenings that we've had of the film, you can hear a gasp from the audience at that point. He was an extraordinary character, and you know, there were times in the edit where me and the editor were really trying to work out whether he was consciously lying about the fact that he saw a gun, or whether he truly believed that he saw a gun.
Yeah.
And the way that he speaks, we didn't manage to do an interview directly with him. He didn't want to be in the film, and nor did his family. But we managed to get access to the initial police interview that was done with him, which was about 24 hours after the shooting, where he talks through what happened to him. And as you said, he was so confident that he was very surprised that police were even interviewing him, because in his eyes, the whole thing was just very simply self-defense. And he was shocked that the police couldn't find a gun. And at times, actually, I felt like I was in, you know, you talk about layers and metaphors when you're filmmaking. And at points, I thought there was a fascinating moment in the trial where the defense lawyer is criticizing the police for not looking for a gun. And the irony is that Michael Dunn never reported the incident for about 20... He didn't report it, and the police found him 24 hours after the shooting.
He fled. He went into a hotel.
Yeah, I mean, he would say he didn't flee, but clearly, you know, most human beings would have called the police, and at
when
the very least...
Yeah, fire
said,
a
you know,
gun into a car.
Absolutely, and if he truly believed that those boys had a gun, you'd think he would have called the police to say, there are some boys out there in a car with a gun, you should really go down there and sort this out.
Right.
You know, at the very least, you would have thought he would have said that. Anyway, the point that we got very caught up in was it almost felt like this metaphor for, you know, it was almost like the comedy of weapons of mass destruction. Like, the police were being criticized for looking for these weapons that they didn't even know existed, because Michael Dunn hadn't actually reported the crime that there was a weapon out there in the first place.
Yeah.
And but the defense lawyer was so incredible at being able to, all he had to do was sow enough reasonable doubt in the jury's mind. And, you know, thankfully, yes, the second trial led to Michael Dunn being convicted. But it was absolutely amazing that it even took two trials, and that the legal system is set up in a way that that defense lawyer was capable of sowing enough reasonable doubt in the first trial.
And we should bring up this issue of the stand your ground laws that were initially invoked to defend or to basically justify Michael Dunn's shootings. And basically this new paradigm that's been created through these laws, where if you feel like you're in danger and if you have a weapon, you now do not have to retreat. You can actually just simply stand and shoot your way into what you feel is safety for you.
Yeah, and again, there's a moment in the film where there's another witness who was in the gas station, and he pulled up next to the boys, heard the loud music, and in his words, didn't want to deal with that loud music, and he just reversed and parked a couple of spaces further along. So, you know, in that moment, he realized that he wanted to retreat from this loud music. And that's all that Michael Dunn needed to do.
Yeah.
Like, that is just very simply all he needed to do. And instead, he's now in prison for the rest of his life. Jordan's life is over. Ron and Lucy's lives are inadvertently changed for the rest of their lives. And Michael Dunn's fiance is no longer his fiance.
Through just 3.5 minutes of time.
Purely because of that connection you made to that there is no need anymore within the law for this duty to retreat.
Did he in the end formally use that defense, or did he all back away from it?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's very complex, the self-defense laws, and actually it took about an hour for the judge to read the self-defense laws to the jury, and you know, it's some pretty complicated law there. But actually, in this particular case, stand your ground wasn't initially invoked, like the lawyer didn't go for that as a form of defense, but stand your ground is written within the self-defense laws, so in a way he didn't have to.
So it's just sort of implicated there. Yeah. This incident, like the Trayvon Martin shooting, took place in Florida as well. Within Florida, it was big news. It was on the news every night. It wasn't as big news nationally as it ought to have been, or as even the Trayvon Martin shooting was. But how did it, the fact that, you know, well, George Zimmerman got off, Michael Dunn did not. Does that have an impact? Did that have, you think, a ripple effect? Because, of course, when there isn't accountability in the justice system, there are many more George Zimmermans and Michael Dunns who feel that all they have to do when they get upset at somebody is pull out their gun and shoot, and they will be let off.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think that it would have an effect. And actually, whilst making the film, I thought, you know, this isn't just a film for... you know, people who want to see gun control issues or anti-racism, et cetera, et cetera. This is actually a film for people who do believe in Stand Your Ground and do believe in the duty not to retreat, because, you know, Michael Dunn's story is a lesson to them that I'm sure they also don't want to spend the rest of their life in prison for making a mistake. Gun owners don't want that kind of thing. We actually spoke to some NRA members who said, we're not into Stand Your Ground, we're not into... Stand Your Ground being part of the self-defense thing, because inadvertently we might actually end up in prison. So I think it's a warning to gun users as well.
Now, on this issue of putting in the broader framework that we started our conversation with, you mentioned Lucia McBath has a family history in the civil rights movement. She attended this 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Mm-hmm. And she and others like Trayvon Martin's mother have attended hearings in Congress on the Stand Your Ground laws. And this issue has turned them into political activists. How does this movement of parents, of, you know, children like Jordan Davis and Trayvon Martin who've been killed, how do you see this transforming into a movement? I mean, because these are people who know the kind of pain that most of us will hopefully never know.
Yeah, specifically with the film, we've been working with organizations who are fighting for change. And obviously the film is a great tool for those organizations and for Jordan's parents. But I think... more broadly than that, I think it's really important that these, you know, as you said, no parent wants to be in that situation, but parents who are in that situation, it's incredibly powerful when they share their stories, because I think in that way it becomes less about politics with a capital P and, you know, something much more personal and universal. And, you know, I'm sure every parent can understand that type of horror.
Yeah.
And no parent wants to be in that situation. And more than that, again, as was mentioned in the film, that every parent these days has to have this type of conversation, has to talk to their children and explain to them that there are people out there who could, over simple misunderstandings, could actually lead to you being killed. And, you know, a terrible moment happened where Jordan actually turned around to his father after the Trayvon Martin shooting and said, look, Dad, I actually look a little bit like Trayvon. That could have been me.
My goodness.
Very prophetic.
Yeah. And I want to also briefly turn back to the fact that you mentioned that Michael Dunn's family has also been devastated by this. He's a fiancé at the time who took to the stand and who was with him, or she was in the convenience store when the shooting took place in the parking lot. She... to her credit, revealed what it was that Dunn said when he heard the music. He said, I hate that thug music, quote unquote, which really implicated him. And she was crying as she said it. And
yeah, and you have to, yeah, you're right. In some ways I respect, you know, her honesty. She could have forgotten that was said. But also I realized that perhaps she had no choice to say those things, because I think in her initial police interview, she might have said those things. So later on, she would have perjured herself if she then didn't repeat the truth.
Which goes to show the importance of police investigations in the immediate aftermath of these crimes, which doesn't always happen. For example, didn't happen in the case of Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, and the presumptions that are made by the police that, you know, in a cliche way, oh, these are just gang killings, we can look into this more slowly than otherwise.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if you think that because of the attention around the Trayvon Martin killing, the Jordan Davis's killing, was a little bit more conscientiously investigated.
Yeah, I certainly think so. And also the prosecuting team was the same. They're the same team. Angela Corey was the same prosecutor. So, yeah, I think there was an extraordinary amount of pressure on that team to get this one right, because it was perceived, obviously, that they didn't get the Trayvon case right.
Which also is a testament to not just media coverage of these issues, but activism and the kind of work that organizers do on the ground around these issues. The Black Lives Matter movement, having really forced this issue into the public discourse, and films like yours.
Yeah, and I like to think, this could be a fantasy, but I like to think that because Ferguson happened in between these two trials, that perhaps the second jury, had been enlightened somewhat by what happened in Ferguson and realised that Black lives do matter.
Yeah.
And it is very important to understand the difference between the perception of fear and actual fear.
Yeah. And so there's a cultural shift that needs to happen. And I'd like to end, Mark Silver, with a personal question. You're not American. You're not black. You're white. What has personally motivated you to do a film like this? And also through this film and the journey that it's taken you on, what sort of questions have you asked yourself?
I've always been doing work related to inequality and human rights related issues in most of the films that I've made. And I think there are, of course, I come from a different country, so I do have perhaps like the luxury of maybe like a wider perspective on issues inside America, or an external perspective. It gives me like more of a bird's eye view maybe. But at the same time, I think there's so much universality in all of these things. Inequality, it manifests itself in so many different ways around the world, and racism and the kind of construction of how the other is perceived, is prevalent all through the world.
And your documentary is some people have described your style of filmmaking as very polished and unlike the kind of handheld camera feel that some documentaries have turned into. Do you any comments on the sort of style that you approach it with?
Yeah, there's a point where I realized that these types of films and these types of stories, to my mind, if I'm going to make them, I want to make them as cinematic as possible. Because I think there is just as much drama, in real life, in documentary, than there is in fiction. And why shouldn't these films look, aesthetically strong? I think that's a great thing for an audience. I think it's easier for them to have empathy and understand issues when they're presented to them like with strong aesthetic appeal.
So tell us where people can catch the film. It's called 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. It's about the Jordan Davis story. It will be out on HBO later this year. When exactly on HBO?
The end of November on HBO and in the cinemas. I think it opens in New York on Friday, and then subsequently during July it's in various other cities around the States.
And is there a website people can go to?
It's takepart.com/minutes.
Takepart.com/minutes. And we will post that to our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, later today. HBO members can get it at the end of November on HBO directly. Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations on the documentary.
Thank you for having me.
My guest, Mark Silver, is the director of 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break.